Radio Kevale, your animal kiss radio.
Welcome to Radio Kevale.
Hi.
Hey. What's up?
I'm Mitchell.
I'm Santoria. I giggle.
And we have another show. All right. Ooh. So, how you going?
I'm good. How you going?
I'm all right. I'm going to just jump straight into local news here, though.
Cool.
With a bit of medical insight. So people, you might be aware that there's been this sort of like illness going around.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I know. The one I've had.
Yeah. So there's been various sort of strains of this. Mm-hmm. And I thought I had it the other day.
Mm-hmm.
As you may know, I thought I had glandular fever, but I don't. Then yeah. I drank some kombucha tea. Totally fine.
Mm-hmm.
But then I realized that whilst I was ill, I couldn't get this Tom Jones song out of my head. I don't know if other people in Bristol have experienced this, but I just could not stop singing Tom Jones. And I thought, maybe this is part of this weird thing that's going around that I've, like, caught. Mm-hmm. Whilst I've caught sort of an infection or something, I've also seemed to have caught, like, the contagious melodies of Tom Jones. And now I just...
Have you been kissing Tom?
Well, I was just... I couldn't stop singing this song.
Yeah.
And so I thought, this is ridiculous. Mm-hmm. I'm just going to go to the doctors and say that my glands are really swollen. I can't get Tom Jones out of my head. And just in case there are other people in Bristol who are wondering what's going on with this Tom Jones thing in my head, you have Tom Jones syndrome, is what I've been told. Don't worry, I asked the doctor if it's common. And she said, well, it's not unusual. So fear not, people. It's fine. It's not unusual.
It's not unusual to be loved by anyone. It's not unusual to have fun with anyone. But when I see you hanging about with anyone, it's not unusual to see me cry. I wanna die.
Was that good?
Good.
That's my local news. Shall we?
That's good because most of the music we're playing today, this is like the show of silly music, so be prepared. It's coming.
Awesome.
Yeah. So another stuff that we've got coming up, we have, well, we're going to start with the local and global updates as normal. We're going to go to an interview with Southwest Against Nuclear and No New Nuclear as well. Two fantastic women, two fantastic groups. So we're going to interview somebody from the Kevale Cafe Collective about why they're so cool.
Yes. Then we've got some readings from a book that has been released by David Gilbert called Love and Struggle. And we'll talk about this event that's coming up that the Anarchist Black Cross from Bristol are organising, which is going to be a really awesome event, but we'll talk to that when we get to it. And then we've got an interview, keeping with the prison theme, we've got an interview with a member of the Brighton ABC named Bra, who is quite the nerd, quite the talker on the topic, I might say.
He knows his stuff.
He really, really does. So we're discussing sort of, we're touching a little bit about like the history of prison and like the prison industrial complex in England and prison slavery as well, gets a bit of a mention. And then we've got the upcoming events, and...
Oh, we have also a short interview about a squatted social centre in the Forest of Dean. It's only short. We have the full interview. It's already posted up online on Radio for All, so check it out if you want to hear the full thing. I just want to get that out there, so now we're just going to have a little taster of that one as well.
Ah, yes. Cool. Mm-hmm. All right.
Yeah.
Local news. What do we got?
Well, we have, okay, this is from the 325 website. There was a fire cell /FAI burn vehicles in an anarchist solidarity attack on the 19th of February. And this is what was said in the communique. They started by quoting Eat and Billy, who are part of the Indonesian FAI. And they say, the spirit of insurrectionalism is still in the air like a light of hope in this dim atmosphere of the cages of oppression. And the communique goes on to say that we hate rich cunts in BMWs. shocker there.
That's very 3-2. Like, you could have not said that bit, and I could have played the game of guessing where that might have come from. Yes.
Yes, indeed. So we hate rich cunts and BMWs. In fact, they piss us off so much that to show our hate of them and all their and all like them, we set a BMW on fire, another SUV nearby, on Kimberley Avenue, Cambridge, in the early hours of February 19th, right in front of the house of these fuckheads, who obviously have signed up willingly on the side of the massive prison industrial civilization for the destruction of our Mother Earth and against everything we love. Just another small gesture of our war on their world. We were filled with love burning as hot as our hate, our thoughts with Eat and Billy Augustin, who were on trial a couple of days ago in Indonesia for burning a BRI bank in Yogyakarta back on October 7th, 2011. You can read more of the communique on the 325 website. In some good news, Leeds ABC are pleased... Leeds ABC and we're all pleased to hear that some of the anti-fascist prisoners... Austin Jackson and Phil D'Souza have been released. Woohoo!
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, Austin has completed his full sentence and Phil has been released on electronic tag. And they also say thank you very much to the people who supported them while they were inside. Unfortunately, Ravi still remains inside, so until everybody's free.
I'm sorry, the 325 rich cunts?
Rich cunts?
Come on. They haven't addressed their language choice, I guess. But we'll move on.
See what you're getting at.
Yes.
Okay, so Schnee's report on anti-fascists in Hyde. Their title for this was Getting a Hiding, the EDL Getting a Hiding.
Nice.
Yeah, good pun.
That's me giving them a high five with them. That's me and them high-fiving over that.
Virtually.
Yeah, that's it.
So after the disturbances in Rochdale, Asian youth turned out against the wishes of some of the mosque elders to confront the EDL in Hyde. Schnoo spoke to one of the anti-fascists who also made the trip. The planned route for the march was through town. The planned route for the march through town from the train station didn't happen due to the sheer numbers of Asian and around 250 to 300 youth who were gathered outside close to the train station. The EDL had the briefest of marches and were herded along the side of Asda around a side alley into the car park next to the bus station, out of sight of the public, so not really much of a march. The Schnee's report goes on to sort of talk a bit more about what happened and how it all went down, but basically people stood their ground and I think...
That's awesome.
Yeah, yeah. So it's good to hear about that kind of those kinds of things. Also, the legendary 1 in 12 social centre in Bristol, Bradford, of course, 1 in 12 in Bradford, they've been going through a bit of a rough patch. They've had a big effort to sort of get everything refurbished and done up for some fire safety regulations and inspections and things, which they got loads of help, people coming all the way from Slovenia to come and help out with, which is fantastic, and we're all happy to see that that went well. But then just after this happened, 1 in 12 was broken into and smashed up, so there's been damage done and things, so they're just going through a rough patch. They need support and solidarity at the minute, so we have skills to pay the bills, as they say. Go on up and help them out, or if you have some cash, if you have the money to pay the bills.
You don't have skills. You've got a checkbook. Yeah,
go on up and give them a hand as well, because, it's just quite unfortunate, and we want to let them know that we're all with them and sending them our love and support and solidarity. In international news, this is kind of quite sad.
I forgot to say my other local news. Sorry, okay. Is that why you made that gesture?
I don't know, but go for it.
Okay. In local news, guess what's been closed down or was closed down at the beginning of February?
Is it good?
Yes, it is good.
What's that?
As it turns out, Hooters gone bust, huh?
Woohoo! All of them?
No, just the one in Bristol. But all of them.
Yeah.
You never know. Yeah, the CEO's reported it to said business in Bristol went tits up, I'm afraid. I'm sorry, I don't know why I'm doing this. But if you're 12 years old, you're not going to be able to have your birthday with a boob cake, I'm afraid. So I'm sorry about that. But it is closed. The Fawcett Society, apparently, the people behind the closure. But it also, you know, I knew it was there for some time, sort of like boiling away a little bit, and now it's gone.
That's good.
Which is good.
Yeah.
But, you know, it was there for a while.
Yeah, which is bad.
You know what I'm saying? Yeah, it was there.
Yeah.
It's now gone. But, you know, it's always good to show your dissent, I think, if things are there and you don't like them.
Yes, that are bad.
That are bad. Yes, that's all I'm going to say. But there is one in Cardiff as well that's still open. So
really? That's bad.
You can get your cakes there, like they're calling it. So if you did want to show dissent, still to Hooters, just over the bridge. So
not that far.
No, but I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, beginning of February. Done. So, yeah, that's the power of lobbying. All right. Yeah, so well done.
Yes.
Those people behind that. Yes. So, yeah, I was happy anyway. But sorry, international use.
International use. No, that's cool. This is not such good international news. So an anarchist anti-fascist was murdered in Samara, Russia. Friends and his friends and family need support. So on the 9th of February at 6:30 in the morning in the area of Institute FIAN, I don't exactly know what that stands for, a janitor found the body of Nikita Kalin, born in 1991, so still relatively young guy. And so at 8 a.m. the police arrived, so quite slack there. And by 11 a.m. the police contacted the mother of the murdered man. According to Nikita's mother, he was stabbed 61 times. Besides this, his ribs were fractured multiple times. His head was wounded as well. No property was stolen. Currently, a suspect of the murder of Nikita has been arrested, and Nikita's blood was found on that person's clothes. So far, comrades in Russia are suspicious the police will help to cover up the attack. As shockingly, this does happen, that they work either publicly or not publicly with the fascists over there. And an injury to one is an injury to all. His friends and family need support. Please check out the Bristol Anarchist Black Cross to read the full article about this and to find out how to donate and help cover funeral costs and just give some much-needed support and words of solidarity to his family and friends back in Russia. Also, there will be a benefit CAF happening sometime in March at Kabale.
Awesome. Great. I'm glad we're doing that.
Indeed. Okay, so from 325, again, information has been learned from the bourgeois press and from the counter-information... information has been learned from the bourgeois press and from the counter-information website Viva la Anarquia that the state prosecution asked for 15-year prison sentence for the comrade Luciano Tortuga, 12 years for terrorist offences because he's accused of using an explosive device, and 3 years for using false license plates on a motorcycle used for the action. The trial is expected to begin in April, and Tortuga is now in Santiago prison in the hospital section. Cell phone towers were torched by the ALF and ELF in Moscow. I think this is also from the 325 website. In the Moscow region, two cell phone towers were torched south of Moscow. The cottage settlement we chose to disable is a popular site with hunters.
Boo.
And not only that, local residents have decided to add to the abuse of the wildlife and have started two commercial fishing resorts. They breed fish to be hunted by tourists, which is pretty bad. And so in the festive winter spirit, New Year's, Christmas, and Valentine's Day, we decided to send them a message of love and harmony, so one tower was left completely burned out and another one severely damaged. The words of solidarity and support to Marco Comanich, members of the Indonesian FAI, both in prison and on the run, and Sylvia, Costa, and Billy. Our respect and wholehearted support of the action carried out by ITS individuals tending towards the wild, as well as other animal and earth liberation collectives. Long live the ALF and the ELF. Long live the FAI. With love, and they sign it, ALF, ELF, Moscow region. And in Quebec, in the province of Quebec in Canada, they're planning to increase tuition fees by $1,625 over the next 5 years. So 55,000 students are currently on strike to protest this because they're smart cookies. And earlier this week, 15,000 students, they had a protest in Montreal. During the afternoon, the thousands of students who were out, they were marching throughout the downtown, the sort of city centre, all day. And then later during the day, they converged on Montreal's Jacques-Cartier Bridge, leading to a temporary blocking of the bridge and traffic. So not only protesting in the city, but actually disrupting what's going on in the city as well. Montreal riot police were on location, began forcefully clearing student protesters from the bridge and surrounding public streets. As police moved on from the protest using batons, pepper spray against the students who were just basically carrying signs, as is the way it goes with police. This is not the first and will definitely not be the last in a series of clashes over the proposed tuition hikes. And so there's loads of students on strike. This is the most recent strike, but there has been strikes over the past few years as well against tuition fees and the increasing neoliberalization of higher education in Quebec.
All right. Yeah. Students. Nice.
Yeah.
Ugh, that's so fucked.
Yeah. Oh, and have you heard?
Is this going to be a joke?
No, oh. I wish it was. I was trying to...
You had a different tone of voice. This. Yeah.
Dominic Strauss-Kahn.
Ah, right. Yes.
The former head of the IMF, proposed head of the Socialist Party in France, potential... He was supposed to be a presidential candidate until all this stuff came out and sort of slapped him in the face. Which is the bare minimum of what it sounds like he deserves, Esther, being accused of sexually assaulting a worker in a hotel, I think in New York City, and now also being accused of going to weird, high-ranking official sex parties.
Ew! God!
Like that, where he would not handle the money himself, but get other people to handle the money so sex trade workers could come and things like that. So, yeah, just clearly... I mean, it makes sense that a guy like that's in charge of the IMF, that's all I
can say. Yeah, that's... God, can you imagine a worse party?
Yeah.
That's like...
Horrible.
I can't even think of a scenario that would be worse than that.
Or anybody with a bigger ego and more fucked up way of living his life.
Yeah, you don't really have to question anyone. Okay, so also happening around the world, we've got recently, I think at the end of January, there was a bit of a kickoff. Well, I say bit, but I mean a big kickoff in Italy to do with the TAV, which is like a high-speed train line proposal that has, you know, lots of different financial interest and corporate interest and all that sort of crap, which was proposed to like to go into France and, you know, various other places, lots of points of connection and whatnot. And there's like a huge history of people being actively against this train line, which I didn't realize. I didn't know really anything about this. But there's also a big... because you think train line, it's like, yeah, okay. Yeah, I'm against those sorts of things. But there's like this huge history, like 20-year history of like particularly anarchist activists and anti-authoritarian activists who are like... pretty much constantly being arrested and they're blowing up things. It's like a big deal. It's a big like epicenter of activism for, you know, this part of Italy. So there was a situation where during another demo, a bunch of folks were arrested and I think there's six still in prison. I'm not sure what their story is in relation to their charges. Huge demo and... lots of good outcomes aside from people being thrown in prison. But, you know, good that there's so much support there and people are being backed up all the time. But there's six people. But I'm going to post up on the Bristol ABC website because they welcome support. They welcome letter writing support. So I'm going to post that up and definitely encourage people to write to them because they've just gone in and...
Great, and now we're going to go to the song called Anarchie by Me, Mom and Morgenthaler. They're... their classic Montreal ska band, which fantastic ska scene in Montreal. And Me, Mom and Morgenthaler, they're like, they're way old school, but they're fantastic. The song's kind of cooler if you understand French, so get out those dictionaries, guys, so sorry. But it's just basically a wonderful song about why it's wonderful to be an anarchist, which is like really cool.
Quand j'étais une petite fille, on m'a dit bien la prise, à faire ce qu'on me dit, rien savoir de l'air.
Great. So now we're going to go to an interview with Zoe and Lucy, who are from Southwest Against Nuclear and also No New Nukes. So we're going to be speaking with them now. This is Santeria, and we're here today with Zoe and Lucy. So hi, guys.
Hello.
Hello.
What, you guys are both part of Southwest Against Nuclear and also No New Nuclear, is that right?
And Stop New Nuclear.
Stop New Nuclear.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It all means the same thing, basically, yeah.
Nuclear bad.
Yeah.
Great. And so I was wondering, just around Cabela, and I think around, you know, we've heard lots about what's going on at Hinkley, and sort of lots of... we're also going to mention it in the local updates that we do. I was wondering if you could tell us a bit about why you're opposed to sort of the construction of Hinkley C, the Hinkley C nuclear power station?
Yes, well, I think first of all it's important to say here that nuclear is a very bad solution to what is the 21st century energy crisis. We don't believe that, you know, we're also anti-coal. You know, we don't believe the argument is about, oh, we'll have to burn loads of coal if we don't use nuclear, which is, seems to be the mainstream argument of Monbiot and Linus and the like. So we'd like to make that clear. We're opposing Hinkley C in particular because it's the first of a new generation of nuclear power stations that the government want to build. And also that the developer, EDF, is a very notorious corporation. It's already got some of its employees in prison for, was it infiltrating the Greenpeace organisation? And it has a very bad employment record with its workers as well. So, yeah, we don't like EDF either.
Simple action you can take, in fact, is to boycott EDF. EDF supply about 60% of the homes in Bristol with electricity. Some of that electricity is from nuclear power. It's a very simple way of telling them that you don't support nuclear power or the building of new nuclear power stations that are going to be bigger and more dangerous than the previous nuclear power stations.
Yeah, definitely. And I saw sort of a thing recently on Indie Media sort of saying there's no evacuation plan for this area if there is some, because we're coming up to the anniversary of what happened in Japan. And so just, and that was sort of highlighted that there's no plan for what happens if there is, you know, a nuclear meltdown or whatever that happens in the area.
Yeah, because they all this development is being done on the belief that this accident can't happen here, which of course is a nonsense. There can be earthquakes in Britain. There has been a tsunami up the River Severn. Okay, it might have been in the 17th century, but that doesn't mean it can't happen again. There's no such thing as a totally safe, no accident nuclear power station. And when the accidents happen, they are catastrophic. They have repercussions over vast areas of land, and these repercussions go on through generations because levels of radiation affect the DNA of all living organisms. So what's happening in Japan could happen here. We have, if you look at Belarus and the people who are affected by the Chernobyl disaster, they have very high levels of deformities in young people and a lot of sickness. And this is caused by the high levels of radiation that those people have been exposed to. So it's very, very serious. And not having an evacuation plan is a total irresponsibility by the people who have power in our lives. And it's also just a negation of the fact that nuclear power is very dangerous.
And Hinkley Point is our friendly local nuclear power station. We are well within the 50 mile evacuation zone recommended by the US and by France. We've also got Oldbury Nuclear Power Station to the north of the city, so we're well surrounded already by nuclear power. These stations are being shut down. Oldbury was shut down, in fact, last week. Hooray!
Hey.
But they want to build more. And we're saying, look, let's just deal with the problems we've already created. Let's not create more legacy and more toxic waste.
Yeah, definitely. And I guess they didn't think the accident was going to happen in Japan either, and it did, so you just...
Oh, no, I mean... you know, the government was adamant that it couldn't happen there, you know. I mean, all nuclear powers say that, you know.
They're a highly developed technological society. They've got all sorts of technology and they're very sophisticated, and they were a modern nuclear power station. Accidents can still happen.
Yeah, definitely. And so I was wondering, you mentioned just quickly there, Zoe, just about some of the stuff that folks have been doing to show their opposition, but could you tell us a bit more about what people from your groups have been involved with and doing?
Well, the history of this movement goes way back. 1987, Stop Hinkley, the local group, was formed, and they actually prevented a new build at that stage. It's now come out of the closet again. The government are promoting a new nuclear renaissance of new builds. Since that was announced, everyone's been scrambling to mobilise, because we all thought that that issue was dead and gone and we didn't have to deal with it anymore. One group is the National Network of Stop New Nuclear. We organised a big blockade of Hinkley last October. Hundreds of people came down and showed their feelings about it, and it was actually a really nice day. We had sunny weather and it was all good. No, only one person got arrested. And we've then also just recently, because Hinkley is beginning the process of development, they've got preparatory works about to start on site, so people decided to take more direct action, and some guys occupied some trees in a wood down there that's going to be cut down. They were evicted after a few days, so then we went in again and we occupied a barn in the middle of the site, just where the new power station is going to be built. The barn's got bats in it and it's going to be demolished. The bats are going to be evicted, as have been the badgers and various other wildlife. And we're still holding that barn as a squat under Section 6, and they are trying to evict us as we speak.
Oh, wow. Yeah,
it's going to the Royal Courts of Justice tomorrow morning. They're going for repossession of the barn and an injunction against all further protests on that site. So, yeah.
We've pissed them off.
We've really pissed them off. But, yeah, it's a bit of a nail-biting time for the whole movement at the moment. But we're hoping they won't get such a total injunction.
Yeah, definitely.
Watch this space.
Yeah, definitely. And so sort of what kind of stuff do you have planned for the future? Because I know there's something coming up March 10th and 11th as well. So can you tell us a bit about that?
We've got another blockade planned. Ooh. March the 10th and 11th. That's the day that last year that things went wrong at Fukushima. They had the earthquake, the tsunami, and that caused an accident at the nuclear power plant, Fukushima Daiichi. And that accident is still ongoing.
Yeah, very much. I mean, I think the media, the world's media, have been very silent about what's going on at Fukushima. It's by no means over. Nuclear accidents go on for a long, long time. The reactors are still in an unstable condition, even though they've been officially said that they're in cold shutdown. But we know there have been further aftershocks, and there are still a lot of queries around what is happening inside the reactors. And the Japanese government are still in a mess about what they're actually doing with all the radioactive waste. They're exporting it, they're taking it to other places in Japan. Tokyo itself is suffering from high levels of radiation now. So it's still really an ongoing crisis, and the nuclear industry is so powerful, it manages to silence the world's media on a lot of the truth that is going on there.
So we're getting as many people as we can to go down to the site at Hinkley. We're going to be surrounding the existing power stations. We're going to have a noise demo, pinning stuff on fence. That's fairly friendly stuff. And then we're going to go back and blockade the gates to the site. And we're hoping to hold that for 24 hours, prevent any vehicles going in and out, and piss them off a bit more, I guess, is the general idea. And just it really helps to go to these blockades, because you get a feeling of how the movement is growing and how many energetic people are involved and want to stop this happening and are just voting with their feet by showing up at this.
Yeah, you definitely do hear about it more and more, which is a good sign, I think, definitely. And I was wondering, before we wrap up, how, I know you guys have weekly meetings here at Cabela's, so you can tell us a bit about how to get in touch with you guys, when the meetings are, should new people come along, all that kind of stuff.
New people would be very welcome to come along to our meetings.
Definitely, as many people as possible.
We run off our feet at the moment. We're running stalls and we're doing lots of stuff to do with the blockade, and we're supporting the camp as well. Meetings are at 7:30 on a Wednesday evening. We're usually in the cafe area. If you want to find out more, you can email swanactive, swanactive@gmail.com. Or if you just want to find out more information, it's a big subject. We can't cover it all here. It's at stopnewnuclear.org.uk. It's a website for the National Alliance that we're part of.
Yeah.
Great. So there's nothing else to add. I'd like to thank you and hope to hear more and maybe see more of what's going on.
Okay. See you at the blockade.
And so... now we're going to go to the song called Muslimic Ray Guns, and it's a remix by Autotune. So some of you may have seen this when it was sort of originally came out, the interview with the guy who was not the sharpest knife in the drawer, gave an interview about why he was going out on an EDL march, and it's because he's worried about Muslimic Ray Guns.
There's a sense of incoherent anger. People are angry, but they can't explain why.
Hello, sir, and why are you here today?
I'm here to protest, right? I'm going on a march. I want Britain to be back British. I want Britain to be back British. I'm going on a march. I want Britain to be back British. I want Britain to be back British. Got interracial law and the Muslimic infidel. They're trying to get their law over our country. And it's it's happening. It's happening in other countries. It's happening in every country. You got Muslimic Ray Guns. Muslimic Ray Guns. You got Muslimic Ray Guns. Ray Guns. Ray Guns. You got Muslimic Ray Guns. Muslimic Ray Guns. You got Muslimic Ray Guns. Ray Guns. Ray Guns. You got the Iraqi law, the Muslimic, the Iraqi law. You got the Iraqi law, the Muslimic, the Iraqi law. In London, it's the Muslim, Muslimic law. It's the Muslim, Muslimic law. It's the Muslim, Muslimic law. It's the Muslim, the Muslimic, it's the Muslim infidel. You got Muslimic rape gang, Muslimic rape gang.
Now we're going to go to a reading from some readings from Love and Struggle, which is David Gilbert's new book, which is fantastic.
You have a VAC prepaid call from
David Gilbert,
an inmate at Auburn, a New York State Correctional Facility. If you wish to accept and pay for this call, dial 3 now. To hear the cost of this...
My first demonstration was a picket line protesting segregated and, more to the point, inferior education for black children in Boston. I don't remember the exact time and place, but the first time I saw him speak on TV, this ripple went through my chest. My heart leapt to his idealism, responding with, "That's what it means to be human, to care about people, to lead a moral and engaged life." Despite my initial defensiveness, black power taught an important political lesson. The need was not, as I had once thought, to shake the moral conscience of America. Those in power knew very well what they were doing. The point, rather, was to overturn who had power, from the small elite on top to the vast majority underneath them. Students, in addition to taking a stand on the great issues of the day, were saying something about what kind of institution we wanted to be part of.
We could not be free, grow, and acquire the knowledge we needed in a structure based on oppressing other people. We demanded that the university stand on the side of humanity.
We had been nurtured and mentored. We had blossomed and grown. We had been inspired and learned so much. Students for a Democratic Society was born in response to the courageous breakthroughs of the national liberation movements in the Third World and the determined struggles of people of color within the United States.
The turning point came in January 1967 when Ramparts magazine published a series of color photos of Vietnamese children burned by U.S. napalm bombs. I've never gotten those pictures out of my mind. From then on, for me, for many of us, it was all out to end the war.
We saw how systematically our government crushed peaceful and democratic efforts for the poor. At the same time, revolutionary movements around the world were mobilizing the oppressed and achieving dramatic social change. It was time for us to move from protest to resistance.
The phone wakes us up at 2 a.m. This is Sunny. Everyone has to clear out of the apartment, the familiar but now breathless voice urges. Immediately, don't stop to pack. The four of us are out of the Pine Street apartment and into the night in minutes with just the clothes on our backs. We carefully weave our way to another safe house. There we wait until 6 o'clock to send our one non-fugitive back to check out the area. He reports that the Pine Street apartment is swarming with police and FBI.
As my son approached college age, he became the strongest advocate for my expressing my sorrow and regrets for the loss of lives and pain caused by our actions on October 20th, 1981, in a direct and forthright manner. And I've done so publicly on a number of occasions. The colossal social violence of imperialism does not grant those of us who fight it a free pass to become callous ourselves. Especially in fighting for a just cause, we need to take the greatest care to respect life and to minimize violence as we struggle to end violence.
From inside prisons, I've seen in even more detail and with greater intensity how central and deep racism is in this society, with the black imprisonment rate being something like 8 times that of whites, and especially with mass incarceration that spearheaded to the government's counterattack against the 1960s upsurge in the black and Latino communities.
While I've been kept in the most restrictive of New York's prisons, I have not faced the near total isolation of the supermaxes, such as California's Pelican Bay and the federal prison in Florence, Colorado.
Like all prisoners, I deal with a major loss of control over many aspects of my life, arbitrary authority, and physical separation from loved ones and activities. But I have a tremendous amount of love in my life.
And I've been able to stay engaged politically with the world and our movements. One surprising benefit of prison has been the opportunity to meet, although under these unfortunate circumstances, several ex-Black Panthers who are also political prisoners in New York State. Naturally, each individual is different, but all of them have been special and valued friends with useful analyses of what's happening in the world, thoughtful reflections on history, and a still burning passion for qualitative social change. Any humane alternative to the present order has to be based on solidarity with the rest of humanity, but also it has to offer a realizable alternative to plunder by showing Americans that there are less wasteful, more sustainable, and more satisfying ways to live. While many complications and limitations create obstacles on the road towards a strong and growing movement, this new surge of energy, spirit, and activism is exhilarating and very encouraging. My fondest hope for this book is that it can be of use in the ongoing struggle. We study history to help us become more effective at making history. What matters most is what we all do from this point on. In Love and Struggle, David Gilbert from Auburn Correctional Facility.
Now we're going to go to the song Riot by Usual Suspects, which is also another classic, fantastic song.
will speak directly to these people and make the situation perfectly clear.
Okay, now we're going to go to an interview with a member of Brighton ABC. His name is Bra. He knows a lot about prisons. I'm going to mention, though, because I had to condense basically an hour of chit-chat. Well, I say the word chit-chat fairly liberally.
Yeah.
I mean him talking for like 55 minutes on prisons. I had to cut out some really interesting things, so I just want to like say those now because they're not actually going to be in the interview because I couldn't like wedge them in appropriate places. But did you know, and this is what I've learnt, do you know where the origin of the word screw comes from?
I have an idea, maybe because I heard Bra talk about it somewhere else recently, but you tell me.
He was saying that there used to be like a handle, like a crank system in certain cells that you'd have to like spin like 10,000 times a day in order to get food and shit like that. Like it wouldn't be connected to anything, it's just like so you get food and so basically you wear yourself out. And it's just the monotony of fucking prison. But there was also one that, and he made some reference to Oscar Wilde on a treadmill, which I'm not familiar with Oscar Wilde, but maybe that resonates with other people, that you would be, like, partitioned on treadmills so you couldn't see other people, and it would just be, like, all wooden discs and things like that. And so you'd just have to, like, be on a treadmill for, like, 8 hours, and occasionally they would be connected to, like, things that would be useful, like water pumps and whatnot, but then often they wouldn't. But the screw is the bit that a screw could push into, like, the wheels to increase the resistance.
Mm.
So if you're a particular
yeah.
toss, you could, yeah, basically it was the screw who could control the level of resistance, so... That's where the term screw comes from, which I thought was really interesting. And potentially a good trivia question, dare I say.
Yes. Make note.
And we talked a lot about prison slavery which I'm really interested in because I recently discovered at Horfield Prison, which is very local to where we are right now, you know, well, I suppose a lot of people wouldn't be surprised, although, I don't know, that prison slavery is fucking rife, but that when I was, because I had to go to Horfield Prison, because I have this bike back scheme there, and people may or may not be aware that a prison wage is about £8 to £12 a week, depending. So basically, it's slave labour that they build bikes and then they sell on the bikes under the guise of, oh, prisoners will get skills, but, you know, the reality is you can choose to do these skills or you can sit in your cell, basically. Mm-hmm. So whether you wanted the skills or not, you're probably going to choose them because you don't want to sit in your cell all day and you don't really have the choice about what skills you might want or what you want to pursue while you're in prison. You're basically just get given a whole sort of a small series of options, mm-hmm. and you can just choose one of those things. So I had the displeasure of, like, going to Horfield to see this bike back scheme, and I was very inquisitive when I was there about the, like, labour practices that were happening. And prisoners for Remembrance Day, as a part of the slave labour concept, were the ones that were putting the fucking Remembrance Day poppies in the thing. Mm. Which is just like, if that's not the prison industrial complex, like, right there, all-encompassing fucking who doesn't profit from prison? Definitely. Yeah, you know, we've got people who were remembering who have died in a war, and now the prison, you know, I'm sure everyone could just draw the links there. Yeah, he's also involved in the campaign against prison slavery, so he's very knowledgeable on that as well. He was saying that as a part of prison slavery, you know, it's almost like prisoners are earning their, you know, you have to earn your keep now to be imprisoned, that so much of the prison itself is made by prisoners. The bars that imprison you, a prisoner has made. The door which closes you into yourself, a prisoner has made. Your boxer shorts, your socks. You know, at some point he was saying, you know, food used to be grown on site to feed the prison. Like, you know, it just becomes this little silent bubble that people don't want to, like, actually acknowledge, even though as soon as you start talking about it, anyone with a brain can see prison doesn't fucking work. And yet the reason that it's churning out all this sort of shit and why they exist to such an intense degree now is because there's so much money and industry behind it. And now it's this, it is capitalism to the extreme, basically.
Yeah, a phase of mass incarceration that we're facing now.
Yeah.
People, like, the actual crime rates have gone down
in
years, but however, the length of prison sentences has increased, and more and more people are getting imprisoned, more and more people are getting thrown into this incredibly abusive and horrible system. You know, I think they say about 70% of the people that go inside have two mental health issues and things.
Yeah.
Outrageous.
Like, let's connect that, you know? Yeah. And we were also, he was also saying about how, like, in the US particularly, that it's quite common for warmonger businesses to be owning prisoners, so to speak, and then they will build helmets and fucking circuit missile, blah, blah, blah. And you get this, you get to this point where you've actually trained prisoners. Sorry, I'm going quite a rant here. Where you have, like, a lifer or someone who's serving, say, like, you know, a significant amount of time, but then over that time they can become trained in these sort of, like, high level tasks, which might be, you know, stuff to do with missiles and, you know, making all this sort of shit. So you have, like, I just get so angry. Mm-hmm. So you've got this thing, you've got this fucking war machine, which is the reason why we don't have money going into health, going into mental illness, going into fucking education, which is what we need to be doing in order to get people out of prison. And, you know, that's where community alternatives, that's where the answer is in there.
But they quite often say literacy rates for school children of school age are a good indication of future rates of incarceration.
Yeah, that's
so
no surprise.
There is that cycle that's quite clear.
Yeah.
And things. And, like, it serves an interest. It's a full functioning part of capitalism.
Exactly, yeah.
And it serves that interest. And I think in the UK, people quite often look to the States and say, ooh, it's so bad over there. We're not as bad as that. However, the UK, and I mean England and Wales specifically, that's how statistics that generally tend to be calculated, are the leaders in Europe of incarcerating people, of incarcerating children, incarcerating everybody else, you know. So, like, just the UK is in the lead within Europe and things.
Yeah, and I think
working shoulder to shoulder.
Yeah, yeah.
The American,
it's not like
industrial complex.
Yeah, and
Well, I think also one thing to mention in terms of the effects of ongoing neoliberal policies as well is that across, well, at least in the United States and in Britain, that women are the fastest growing group of people who are being incarcerated. So as we're seeing the cuts hit. And as we know, women and children are quite often hit first by the cuts. Women and children are also on the front lines of the sort of fastest moving population of prisoners as well. I mean, this as well, the my inner love of insurrectional ideas comes out in this as well, where you can also argue that what we see in our sort of surveillance society and the way that the war on terrorism, for example, has brought sort of increased surveillance as well into the rest of our lives, and that we see what happens in prisons is only a testing ground for what's going to happen in the rest of our lives and the rest of society. So to think that it's okay to do it to prisoners or to bring in mandatory ID cards for migrants, for example, but as you know, well, I'm an upstanding white middle class Brit, and I'm going to be fine. You're not, and so
yeah,
you know, it's just they get hit first, they or we, however you want to see it, get hit first.
Yeah, the glory of the prison. Yes. Yeah. Woo-hoo. Yeah. So that was a good interview, but depressing interview. Yeah.
So after that, we're going to listen to Newport State of Mind, and apparently there were some songs made about Newport. One was like this song made by people who aren't actually from Newport, and they made a song about Newport. And then one was by people who are actually from Newport about Newport. So I hope I've got the right one. This goes out to all, you know, I send this with lots of love to all the lovely anarchists in Newport who are keeping it real. You know who you are. Especially a handful of you. No, I'm sorry. I'm not being fair to Newport. Don't start hating me.
We've just lost all our Newport listeners. Yeah.
Well, I'm just chatting to Bra from Brighton ABC and from the Campaign Against Prison Slavery, and we're going to have a chat about the prison situation. How are you going?
I'm fine.
Okay, cool. We'll just dive in.
No, fire away.
Yep. So England has quite the history in relation to punishment and imprisonment, and there have been a lot of reform and changes in attitudes over the century. So can we just talk a bit about England's history, and can you tell me about what you know in relation to those changes?
Prison is actually a relatively recent development in England. It's used much more on the continent prior to, say, the 18th century.
Mm-hmm.
Before then, the prisons were very much local, small-scale things, and usually they're merely to hold people before trial, pre-trial. I mean, the classic sort of Count of Monte Cristo idea is very much an exception. And also there was a plethora of small privately owned prisons, like people, you have heard the term the clink.
Yeah.
For prison, and that was actually a privately owned prison owned by the Bishop of Winchester. But with the Elizabethan Poor Laws, late 16th century, there was the beginning of the move to the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. There were a lot of itinerant rural poor, that so-called vagabonds.
Yep.
And they ended up in a new thing called the House of Correction, which was often a wing to the local jail, and also known as the Bridewell. That's a more common name for it. And they were sort of like a reformatory prison for itinerant poor and labourers, particularly for labourers who refused customary, very low wages that they were earned prior to the enclosure of the commons. You have to a punishment, learning industrious habits. From the 18th century onwards, the House of Correction became much more for holding sentenced petty criminals for short periods of hard labour.
Yeah.
At the same time, there were things like the development of transportation towards to the North American colonies, which was again a form of indentured labour where people would be transported. They would then be effectively, their labour would be purchased by some local merchant in North America, and they would have to then pay off their debt with labour, and at the end of that, they would be free.
Yeah.
So this was very much what was happening there, and with the progress towards the Industrial Revolution and the migration of the rural population towards the cities, there became obviously a problem with the increase in the you know, these vagabonds, these people committing crime. So there was very much a need to find some solution to that. The discovery of Australia was obviously a help because instead of they were indentured labour effectively there as well, but instead of being sold to merchants, they actually were in the hands of the Australian government, so they worked directly for the government. And towards the end of the 1700s, you've got very much an increase in the moral Christian attitude towards, you know, we shall reform the prisons. Yeah. You've got people like John Howard and writing the state of prisons in England, state of the prisons in England and Wales. I think that came out in 1777. Mm-hmm. And then towards the end of that, you've got very much legislation being brought on board. Moving on from that, there was things that happened, like the ending of public hangings in 1868. And then there was, because of the power of the, you know, the sort of public sentiment that had come about, unlike on the continent where, you know, it was very much a situation where people would riot, you know, the general public revolted against the idea of, you know, hanging as a public spectacle. Mm. It was very much that it was had to be taken inside the prisons in order to hide it away from the public sentiment. There was also, they couldn't build prisons fast enough effectively, and they had to, this is on a national level, they had to take all the local prisons into control, but because they vary so much and because of the corruption in local prisons, they decided that the best way to do it would be by nationalising it. So eventually the 1898 Prison Act ended up abolishing hard labour and bringing an end to the separate system because they, you know, they just needed more space. So before then, all cells had been individual. The Victorian prison cells that you now find two or three prisoners banged up in were effectively for one person. So the 1898 Prison Act ended hard labour, and prison work was then meant to be productive, meant to actually, prisoners were meant to effectively earn their keep. And, you know, there was this reformative notion to it. It wasn't just there strictly for disciplining the self, it was there for disciplining the morals. Supposedly, you know, meant to be reformed. It was still there as a potential, you know, however much the Victorian prison reformers like to think that they were, you know, the bee's knees, they definitely weren't. I mean, prison was still very much a brutal, nasty experience, however much, you know, the rise of the penal welfare notion of rehabilitation in prisons took hold through the early 20th century.
Yeah, well.
So this is, you know, this is what kind of brings us up to even the notion that, as I say, the notion that, you know, the prisons were being gradually reformed. I mean, it was very, very gradual and very, very begrudging reforms to a certain extent, largely to prevent unrest within the system.
Can you explain the term prison industrial complex and what that means for England's prison system and working against prison in all its forms around the world?
The prison industrial complex is very much a North American concept. It was tied into the idea of the military industrial complex because of the power, the lobbying power of these private outsourcing companies like Correction Corporation of America and people like Sodexo and Serco and G4S. They put vast amounts of money into, as I've already explained, lobbying Senate for contracts with the Federal Prison Service and also at the local level. And they can, because of their financial power, they can turn up in a little out-of-the-way Sticksville, USA, and offer to build a brand spanking new prison where there's virtually no local employment, and you know it's very difficult for local communities to refuse to do that. So that's the model for the prison industrial complex in general. Because of the government's, the coalition's decision that they can't afford to keep borrowing money, and Britain's broke, they have to find ways of cutting back on money for running the Ministry of Justice, which runs the prison system. So HM Prison Service has to save 25% of its budget in the next 4 years. The other thing is that, I mean, I mentioned prison labour. I mean, other companies that see it as a good option to get into the prison system to get people, prisons working for them at very low wages. I mean, I could give you examples of companies that do work for, do use prisoners to do, but currently it's very much low-level, unskilled, largely unskilled piece work stuff, except, as I mentioned earlier on before, in the private prison system where you have very much more high-tech things. I mean, you've prisoners making double glazing, and some of them even work for internet providers. So the idea is, you know, to try and get private finance in, so you get people, companies in providing training for prisoners. But at the same time, they're also using prisoners for labour. I mean, there's an example of Speedy Hire, who are a plant hire company. They do everything from, you know, if you want to sand your floors, you can hire that, to the lighting and barriers you see on motorways when you... They have... four workshops in England and Scotland employing prisoners. They probably employ about and entrain about 200 prisoners in their workshops. It's difficult to get hold of the exact figures, but in the past few years, they've actually made a close 39 of their depots and made 300 of their workers redundant. large parts of those the jobs that they were doing are now being done by prisoners on prison wages. I mean, I don't know exactly the wages that are paid in these specific things, but they'll be on something like £12 a week for 32-hour week. Mm. I mean, they may be on slightly more. I mean, there's a system called the Incentives and Privileges Scheme, whereby prisoners who are good boys or girls, keep their nose clean, can earn higher wages. There's basic, standard, and enhanced, and there'll probably be people in training will probably be in the enhanced level, and most publicly run prisons can be anywhere between something like £12 upwards to very, very rarely much more than £20. Private prisons, it can be more than that, but I mean the average wage in UK, in England and Wales, in prisons is about £8 for 32-hour week. That can be people also who are paid for taking education classes as well. But so it's, you know, it's very much, I mean, people doing mundane things like packing little packets of screws, do it on a piecework basis. Something that, you know, most was being done in homes across the houses across the country back in the 50s by mums trying to earn pin money. But this is what prisoners do, and they can possibly, you know, they'd probably be earning about £6-8 a week on doing that.
Yeah.
And learning nothing, effectively learning no skills, no transferable skills.
Exactly.
And the big move now is to try and get back some of the offshore jobs that have gone to Southeast Asia back into the country, done by prisoners for that sort of wage, sort of wage being paid to people in Singapore or wherever.
And then we can feel good about that.
Exactly.
That we're keeping jobs in England that way. Yeah.
Exactly.
Oh, lovely. Oh, what an excellent note to end on. Did you want to add anything else?
No, I think that kind of covers it. I mean,
not that great. Okay. Yes. Okay, thanks. Okay.
What? Who? What are you saying, brah? It's Newport, isn't it? Wicked.
Q.
Come have a drink up a Ridgeway next to Classy Cuts. This is Newport, we don't even have a Pizza Hut. Newport, down the M4 motorway, famous for cheese and chips, not Craig Bellamy. I catch you in our kitchen, and hey presto, I'm gonna melt you if you've never been to Chepstow. We had six nightclubs, but most closed down. Visit Newport, it's still a party town. Get on the dance floor, mind the smoking ban. But you won't see Charlotte Church or Gavin Hensam. Big up to Paul Flynn, not the Welsh Assembly. That's in Cardiff, so it don't mean shit to me. Shirley Bassey, she's just like the Queen. Not from Newport, I've probably never been. See me at Bailey's on Tuesday for the quiz. But you won't though, because the truth
you're
is
you're not from Newport. You've probably never been there either. I'll bet you a fiver you're not from Newport. You've probably never heard of Pilgwenny or been to Liswary.
Newport where your missus is a nutter. She got curly teeth and she walks with a stutter. If you wanna know about our little town, pay money at the Severn Bridge and come on down. Ride around all day on a Newport bus, on an X15 and read the Argus. We got a sports village and a velodrome. Six drive through McDonald's for your journey home. From Newport Stadium to Rodney Parade, the Premier Inn where you probably stayed. Don't have a Debenhams but we got TK Maxx. Once you've had port, you never goes back. So if you want cheese on your chips, medieval ships, see mattresses and skips, then comes take a trip. Visit John Foss Square, you knows I'll see you there. But people might stare because
you're not from Newport. You've probably never been there either. I'll bet you a fiver you're not from Newport. You probably never heard of Grinder, Ringland or Risker.
I can't believe you ripped off my style, but to be honest, it made me smile. Newport, so good they named it twice. We got a visitor's centre if you
you're
need advice. Because
Newport, you've probably never been there either. I'll bet you a fiver you're not from Newport. You've probably never heard of Pilgwenny or been to Liswary. You're not from Newport. You've probably never been there either. I'll bet you a fiver you're not from Newport. You probably never heard of Grinder, Ringland or Risker.
Yeah, Newport, it's wicked. Open the Ryder Cup 2010. And we got a Wetherspoons. It's wicked. Come and visit soon. Loves you. Who knows it makes sense?
Now we're going to go to an interview with Frank White, who's going to talk to us about the Squatted Environmental Centre Eco Village happening in the Forest of Dean.
And I'm here with Frank White from the Forest of Dean Eco Village. Hey there.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Hey, thanks. And so I was wondering, we've heard a little bit of talk about what's going on in the Forest of Dean, but I was wondering if you could tell us a bit what's happened, how it started, and all that kind of stuff.
My involvement started in the end of summer last year at the Reclaim the Fields gathering in Bristol. After that, we got together a crew and started squatting some buildings in the Forest of Dean and started something called the Forest of Dean Eco Village. So we've been there since the summer, moving around. We got evicted from the farm building that we were squatting and then started living in the forest. We've been creating dwellings in the forest and doing some guerrilla gardening and getting moved on by the Forestry Commission. And in the new year, on the first full moon of 2012, we squatted an environmental education centre in the Forest of Dean that has been closed by the cuts. And we've reopened it on a voluntary basis, and we're basically having open days and doing all sorts of, like, sustainable education stuff.
That sounds great. So sort of what kind of an average day, or what are the sort of kinds of things that you're doing at the center? How's the outreach with the community going as well?
Okay, average day is wake up and make a cup of tea over an open fire. So, you know, fire lighting skills are a must. Then we've got four buildings to hold down. We've got some security guards to contend with. That's a daily sort of thing we do. Then we run skill shares and workshops. So we've set up a regular Saturday skill share and workshop day where people from the local community are free to come up and check out what we do, which does happen. So we have had quite a bit of positive response from the local community. There's people who are willing to share their skills, like we have some foresters who want to do coppicing workshops. We've had roundhouse building workshops, blacksmithing workshops. Local herbalists have come down, people doing weaving, people doing basket making, people doing wild food foraging and bushcraft skills. So it has been, so far, a great success on a medium scale, but I think the potential there is for it to really kick off and make a real big impact with the local community. So, you know, we've got quite a good image in one of the local newspapers called The Forester, which is like once a week. Then we've got a sort of a medium to fair conservative paper that's called The Citizen, that's a daily that that we've got a relationship with. We're trying to develop and improve the sort of information that comes out through that one. But there are some roads that we need to go down to do with proactive community outreach, rather than just opening our doors up and waiting for them to come to us. We would like to do a little bit more stuff, like maybe put posters up in the local churches, because that's where the local communities do have some sort of cohesion and where people might be willing to open their hearts and sort of come down and make roads to sort of have a relationship with us. And so there's quite a sensitive community relationship that goes on there, because the Forester Dean does have an extremely long history of resistance against oppression, but that also means that the communities are quite strong in their sense of self and their sense of history. So that can have slight adverse effect in relationship to people coming into the community. So if they see us as outsiders and doing something that is not in the interest of the local community, then there could be a conflict there. But at the moment, the prevailing sort of message that we get through is that they see us as a positive force. We put out a lot of info over the internet and through the newspapers, especially The Forester, I mentioned, that has been quite good at putting our message across. We put a lot of information through to the council about our intentions, statements of intent, that we'd like to be caretakers. We'd like to look after it on an interim basis, that we don't want to cause any trouble or have costly legal fees. So we've offered to negotiate a leaving date and things like this. So we are trying to do everything above board and in a transparent way as possible, to make sure that people feel like they could take ownership of it, and that we're open to have people come up. And essentially, the bottom line is that it needs to stay open for the community as an environmental education centre.
Okay, and now we're going to go to Cyndi Lauper, Girls Just Want to Have Fun, because ain't that the truth?
Why did you choose this song?
Because it's classic. Because it's so good. And because I think more people really need to be made aware of how good some Cyndi Lauper songs are.
Yeah.
So hi, we're back, and today we're speaking with David from the Café Collective. Hey there.
Hi there.
Hey. And so the Café Collective routinely helps pack Cabele and serves a fantastic vegan food. So I was wondering if you could tell us a bit about what the goals are for the collective.
Yes, well, I think there are a number of goals. Obviously, one of the goals is to raise money, funds to pay the bills for Cabele to operate the way it does. So that's really an important part of the goal. But the other one, there are a number of them, and another is to create wholesome vegan food in a supportive, non-hierarchical way at minimal cost, and that is accessible as possible to all, i.e. low-cost food to eat. That's also important. And promote veganism, as Cabele is a vegan space, so it's vegan food is what we do. But moving on from that is really to create a community. I think creating a community through sharing food is important. So we're putting a decent meal inside people. In having a cafe and having crews, cook crews during the weekend for the Saturday morning brunch and the Sunday evening meal, and now a weekday meal one evening during the month, we can create a collaborative, friendly, welcoming atmosphere for everyone involved in that, because at its most basic, food nourishes our bodies, but also the act of cooking together in itself can be food for our souls in a kind of way. And at Cabele, we can subvert the traditional hierarchy of the kitchen chef, often a male kitchen chef, so that we can, at Cabele, we can make cooking a cooperative venture, and even peeling potatoes can be enjoyable as you get to know other people, you know, alongside peeling the potatoes. So it is, you know, the whole activity is really good. It's an opportunity for people new to cooking, for masses, for many people, to learn new skills and gain confidence, particularly for people also not so familiar with vegan cooking. But yeah, going back to the first point, funds is really important for Cabele to have funds to cover its costs and to pay for its expenses and to develop the community.
So I noticed in the cafe there's been a recent trend towards gluten-free and sugar-free sort of food being served, which is great, obviously. And I was wondering, has the Café Collective been sort of encouraging this, or how's that sort of all come about and things? Because I think it does help make it more accessible. You know, vegan is obviously quite a big step compared to normal, you know, the regular meat and two veg diets, which is icky. But this is also quite a new kind of thing that's been going on, which seems to be, you know, people seem to be quite happy with it, and it's been very well received.
Yes, I mean, I think I have, obviously, in speaking, or in being interviewed in this today, I've sounded out a number of people about this question and also the other questions, so that I'm not speaking for myself. I'm speaking, hopefully, what I'm saying represents as much the collective as it possibly can, and this whole issue of gluten-free and sugar-free, something that does raise quite a lot of discussions within the collective. Certainly, it in the main depends on the cook crew of that meal and how the relevant kind of dishes they're making, and whether they've got the capacity or desire to make something that's gluten-free. And a number of meals I've made, we've been doing that. But I don't think it's something which we have policy on. Mm-hmm. It's something that if it comes up through the cooking, that we could make a slight variant on one dish, whether it's sort of a pudding or a cake or something something that we can make a sort of pizza, having used gluten-free flour, then, you know, that might happen. But I don't think it's something that we would always do. And obviously, each crew is different, independent. They make their choices about what they make. So, but yes, I said, you think it makes the food even more accessible to more people. But remembering what I said earlier, that for some crews, maybe the majority are not even vegan, or not fully vegan. You know, to make a whole meal that's vegan in itself is a challenge, let alone, you know, make something that's gluten-free or sugar-free. So it can vary depending on who's in the kitchen at any given time.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I guess it's also about sort of some of the, I think the Cakeskill share that happened recently, they had, you know, they did bits on sort of sugar-free and gluten-free or wheat-free cakes and things, which is like, I think it's just quite good because the more we sort of help teach each other, the easier it makes it, you know, for people like myself who are vegan, but I do like sugar. You know what I mean? It's sort of, how do I, you know, instead, how do I replace things, sugar and cakes and things, without using expensive ingredients like maple syrup, you know, and things like that, that sort of, you know, how can you use dates or bananas or that kind of stuff? So it's,
and most dates have sugar in them, which is
shocking.
Yes, I might add, for people who are maybe thinking about being sugar free and they're thinking about dates, I learned that the hard way, the tasty tasty hard way. Yeah, but moving on, sorry.
No, I feel your pain. So just before we wrap up, I want to ask you if a cafe collective has any wishes, has a wish list at all, and so put it out there, and also if you know, do you need more kit, more folks to help out, and if there's anything else, and how can people get in touch?
Sure. Yeah, we do have a wish list, and it's a wish list that comes up every meeting we have about things we would like to see happening, things we would like maybe not to happen, if you like. One collective members, and we all share kind of view that is about, he uses this, I won't name the person, but he probably knows, maybe people know who he is, but we say support the view that one of the classic phrases, property is theft, and so is our pans. And basically one of the issues has been that, done is a tongue-in-cheek, if you like, but basically people, whether they're user groups or volunteers, borrow kit from the kitchen for very good reasons. They're doing stuff that's really important, but for some reason they don't return the kit, and that really has a knock-on effect on the kitchen, because obviously if you're out of, you've got only a few trays, baking trays, then it's gonna be harder to do the cakes or do all the potato wedges or whatever else. And so from time to time we have to do amnesty emails to volunteer list saying, please return our pans.
I have
released the pans.
No, and it is a pain. And basically, you know, and so what we've done more recently is we've marked on all the kit Cabelli, just to remind people if they've got something at home and maybe they've just not realised, maybe they've done an act, some kind of event, and it's been, oh, can you hold on to this? And they realise, oh, yeah, it's actually belonged to Cabelli. Please return it. So in saying that, I'm saying to the community, if you do have anything that belongs to Cabelli, please return it, because it's really, really valuable. That it's valuable kit. It costs Cabelli money in the first place. Some pans cost up to £200.
Oh yeah.
You know, and so really, without that kit, we're limited in what we can do. So that is some kind of wish, if you like, wish the kit. Maybe goes out for good reasons, but then comes back straight away. It doesn't get stuck in under the drawer somewhere or whatever. So that is really important.
Locked in a squat somewhere.
Well,
behind
exactly.
Some side texts, maybe.
Be a whole host of good reasons for why it's gone. It's gone temporarily, but it comes back.
Or they replace it, like good people.
Or they come to replace it, exactly. We don't need to keep on doing these amnesties, which is that bit of a pain. Another wish list is obviously, on the wish list, is more volunteers to get involved in the cafe at the weekend. So that's really important. More people, because sometimes we struggle to get the crews, particularly for a Saturday brunch. There's been a few Saturdays early in the year we closed the cafe because we had no. Which is a real shame. People turned up saying, "Where's my fry up?" You know, they were completely devastated, and anyone would be. Saturday morning fry up. No, end up having to go home for baked beans on toast. I mean, That's a down.
It's an injustice. That's what
No. It's so important that people do get involved and sign up to the Rota. And also, yeah, wish for more people to join the collective, because the more people we have, then better. Because there are a number of kind of ongoing tasks of the, of the Cafe Collective that we have to do. Obviously, cleaning the kitchen, which is not exactly the most inspiring activity, but needs to be done weekly.
Oh, yeah.
Keeping the Rota going, health and safety issues in the kitchen. Yeah, so there are a number of things that, you know, buying in stock, keeping things as up together as we can with stock. All those kind of tasks which have to keep on going in order to make the cafe work. So, yeah, that's another wish list for more volunteers. And yeah, we'll obviously wish that we want to improve the facilities of the kitchen over time. We've got a new food processor now, which is pretty good. And yeah, we want to, as I said, bring in more stock to make it easy for cooks to make food without having to go out around the corner to buy stuff.
Yeah, well, the kitchen is looking good, though. I mean, it's all sort of coming together nicely, I think, since they did the redecoration and everything.
It is.
It's looking quite good.
Yeah, so if you're up for getting involved, you can email kibelicafe@riseupnet.net. You can put your name down on the paper rota, or there's a rota on crabgrass, and you can put your name down for the emergency volunteer list, both of which... by the serving hatch, there's a paper list there for people to put their names to.
Great. Well, thanks. Unless you have anything else to add, I think we're going to wrap up.
Yep.
Yeah.
Cool.
Thank you.
Cheers. Thanks a lot. Rethink Work. There's going to be a discussion at Hydro Books, which is 13 Old Market Street, at 7:30 on February 29th. So, and the sort of blurb for it goes: ever questioned how many hours you work? What would you do if you had more free time? Goodness knows. And this is an open discussion, and we're hoping to about how people use their time and value work. So just open to have a discussion, some thoughts, and share ideas. So come with an open mind to that event.
Hydra, though.
Hydra. Yeah?
Yes.
Yeah. So recently.
Yes. I have a bone to pick with old Hydra.
Ah.
Yes. If you were, we would know whether people were there on Tuesday because it was only about 8 of us.
Yeah.
I gave time to a prison reformer.
Yes, we did give time to a prison reformer after our long rant about prison.
Yeah, God, how embarrassing.
We are definitely not in favor of prison reform. Yes. There was a guy who wrote a book, The Little Book of Prisons, which was, I think, well intentioned.
Maybe.
Maybe, hopefully.
It's a part of the complex.
Yes, yeah. It was... I was hoping for a little bit more. Also at Hydra, which is why Hydra is, like, way cool.
Yeah. Back to Hydra, yeah.
Bristol Against the Arms Trade, also way cool. They're going to be having their meeting there. They meet at Hydra on Thursday, the 1st of March. On the agenda, what is the Achilles heel of the arms trade? Bob will talk about and introduce the topic of drones. So we've talked a lot about that on Radio Cabela as well, because they're clearly quite bad. And so they're also planning a conference on drones. And so they have 4 speakers for the 1st of April, but need to confirm the structure of the day. So they want people to come with ideas and inspiration and all that kind of stuff. So that'll be amazing. And this year, on the 28th and 29th of April, there will be an anti-prison gathering in Nottingham. So the organisers have said that they're organising this gathering not with the intention of forming another organisation.
Good.
Yes, which will stagger and fall almost immediately. Sounds relatively accurate. But in order for those of us who are anti-state and anti-capitalist to work towards, and also oppose, sorry, for those of us who are anti-state, anti-capitalist, and also who are opposed to the prison societies, that we may sort of work towards a weekend to share our experiences and understanding of the current situation. And also...
That would be so cool. I'm there. Cool.
Yeah, totally.
Where is Nottingham?
It's like up north.
Cool. That looks awesome.
March what? 13th.
Yes.
Amazing. Super cool. David Gilbert. David Gilbert is he's a long-term political prisoner. He was part of the Weather Underground and all kinds of other groups as well, and he like notably the Students for a Democratic Society, the Weather and Jordan. Sorry, I'll start that over again. So also March 13th at Hydra Books again.
Yes, Hydra.
They're popular. We're going to be, well, Bristol ABC is going to be hosting a sort of a book launch and film night. So we're going to be showing the Weather Underground movie and also be featuring sort of some of the readings from David Gilbert's new book, Love and Struggle. So this is a book about how David, who is a long-term political prisoner, anti-imperialist, anti-racist, anti-military-industrial complex. And so he's... yes, he's written this new book, so it should be, I'm sure it's a fantastic book, and so we're going to be doing a bit of a book launch for that.
Something else. And what happens in a week from today, which you haven't got on your little list.
Oh.
At least, yes, I do have this day, right? Speaking of prisons, which we are.
Oh, indeed, yes.
Is.
We have letter writing.
Yes.
We'll get there. So yes, Bristol ABC will be hosting letter writing from 6:30 to 8 p.m. at Cabellet Social Centre, 14 Robertson Road in Easton. So come on out, have a great vegan meal, thanks to the Cafe Collective, who are like way cool. And come on out, have some lovely vegan food, and also come and sign some cards, write some letters to prisoners who are requesting support.
Yes, do that. And get involved generally with anti-prison stuff would be my recommendation anyway at this point in time. That's my top tip for the day. Okay, cool. I think that's all.
Yeah, that's us done.
Good evening.